So I'm just going to now look at some of the ethical and moral framework behind the euthanasia debate and caring for the dying patient. And one of the very interesting things is just to see the sort of words that are used by those who are trying to promote euthanasia and assisted suicide. And these are just some of the words that it, the phrases that are used: ensuring a dignified death, the right to die, the right to choose at the end of life, easing the passing, assisted dying, which is one of those incredibly ambiguous phrases, and so on. And what they are all describing is intentional killing, actually something that comes under the Homicide Act. So then we ask ourselves, then why are they using all this kind of euphemistic and frankly confusing language? And I think it's a very important principle and something that you find time and time in the history of medical ethics, and that is that the manipulation of language often precedes the change in action. And there are many examples of this in history. The Nazis did it with, they called their place, which controlled the euthanasia program, the compassionate program for the care of the dying. And why did he choose language like that? Why didn't they just call it 101? But it's something, it says something about us, of the nature of us as moral beings. It's something to do with the conversation we have inside our heads. Did I really kill my patient? No, 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 I was easing the passing. Oh, that's all right then. It's that kind of conversation, the way we describe our actions to ourselves, the way we describe our actions to other people, the words we use are very important. And I've increasingly seen the spiritual significance of words. It's not an accident that the very first time that the evil one appears on the stage, what does he say? Did God really say? In other words, right from the beginning, what the evil one is doing is questioning and testing the words of God. And of course, Christ is the word. So words are actually incredibly important. The words we use. So one of the things you need to look out for, therefore, is look out for the corruption and the manipulation of language. And don't get fooled. That's the evil one has been playing this game right from the Garden of Eden. And he's still playing the same game. And I love this quote that says, "The beginning of wisdom is to call things by their proper names." The beginning of wisdom is to call things by their proper names. So what we're talking about is intentional killing. And as a definition, I would suggest this: intentional medical killing by commission or omission of a person whose life is thought not to be worth living. And of course, assisted suicide is its very close relative. And morally, the distinction between assisting suicide and intentional killing is very, very fine, particularly when, as has been suggested, how do we help somebody dying who with motor neurone disease? Quotes, well, what we do is we insert a cannula, we draw up, calculate the lethal dose, we insert in an automated giving set, computer controlled. But the final act has to be the patient's. The patient has to finally press the button, and if they can't press the button, then we'll have an eye blink detector. You can just imagine the horrors there. Hang on a minute, I've got something in my eye. Oh, bang. But can the doctor who has arranged the whole thing and calculated the lethal dose and set the whole apparatus up, can they really claim morally, well, it wasn't me, I didn't do anything? I mean, I think we can see that actually the distinction between assisted suicide and intentional killing by squirting in a drug is really paper thin. The two main moral arguments that have always been used in favor of euthanasia are these two. And it's interesting to see how the balance between these arguments has shifted. So historically, it's all been about number one. It's all been about compassion. It's all been about people dying in the most horrendous agony. And the way that I've been recently reading, I'm trying to write a book at the moment about on this topic, and I've been reading up more about Holland, and what happened in Holland. It's fascinating to see the evolution of euthanasia in Holland. But it basically is all around compassion, and it's all around the fact that doctors, as they see their patient in agony, they have a duty to stop the suffering. And so, in fact, the way that it evolved in Holland was under the legal doctrine of necessity. So the doctor said, I have a duty to protect life, but I also have a duty to stop suffering. Here is my patient in terrible suffering. My duty, I am compelled by my duty as a doctor to put the patient out of their misery. And so, yes, I am guilty of ending life, but when I go in front of the prosecutor, I will claim the legal doctrine of necessity. I had no choice. I had to stop the suffering. And so that was how gradually, as cases evolved in Holland, they were based around the compassion. Interestingly, that's why in Holland, it's only doctors who can commit euthanasia, because only doctors have the conflict of duties between protecting life and their duty to their patient. The way that it's evolved, it's largely family doctors, GPs, who do euthanasia in Holland. And it is all based around hopeless and unbearable suffering. So the suffering has to be unbearable. In other words, there is no possibility of stopping it. And it has to be hopeless. There is no future possibility of getting better. And if you meet those criteria, then the doctor is moved by compassion and says, I have to do it. Now, of course, what is so interesting in Holland was that there was no tradition. They didn't have Cicely Saunders. They had no tradition of palliative medicine. And you remember one of the great slogans that Cicely Saunders and the palliative care movement came up? You don't have to kill the patient in order to kill the pain. That was one of her great slogans. And of course, it's true. You don't have to kill the patient in order to kill the pain. And so whereas in the UK, the doctor who saw, yes, we're all moved by this terrible sight of a patient in unbearable agony, what we've discovered through the palliative care movement is you don't have to kill the patient in order to kill the pain. That wasn't there in Holland, and therefore the natural response was to kill the patient. And therefore, this is still the argument in Holland, is all about compassion. And so what happens is there are quite a lot of requests. The patient goes to the doctor and says, I want euthanasia, because it's now well known, it's legal, it's over 90% of doctors in Holland support euthanasia and have actually either carried out euthanasia or would be prepared to do it. Another 5%, they wouldn't actually do it themselves, but they'd refer to a colleague. Only less than 5% of doctors in Holland say that they would never do euthanasia and they wouldn't refer their patient. So it's a tiny fraction. The medical profession has taken this on. And interestingly, now the big debate is not about cancer and about terminal illness. The big debate in Holland is about the people who have psychiatric problems but are suffering unbearably. And it's about people with early dementia who know they're going to develop Alzheimer's but are still at the point at which they're still competent. And it's about people who are just, quote, tired of life and have what is called a completed life. I've had my life. I've finished. I'm tired. I'm elderly. I want to go. And I want my doctor to do it. And this is now the big argument that is raging in Holland about the euthanasia for people dying of cancer and so on is basically accepted as a normal procedure. But the argument is still around compassion. And interestingly, apparently, what happens in Holland, quite a lot of patients request euthanasia. The doctor assesses the situation and says, basically, you're not suffering enough. So therefore, I refuse. It's only when you meet the level of suffering, which is high enough, the doctor will say, okay, now I'll do it. Now, the interesting thing is that when Peter mentioned the House of Lords in the 1990s, it was largely, a lot of it was about compassion. And the cases in focus were people dying in cancer. Do you remember Lillian Cox and all that? Or people dying in terrible agony and the doctors being unable to stop the suffering. Now, it's completely shifted. And in the West, in the UK, in the USA, the argument is not about compassion and it's not about suffering. It's about autonomy and human rights. It's about my choice, my right to control my life, my human rights. If I have control the rest of my life, if I can control every aspect of my life, where I live, what I do, where I go on a holiday, where I work, who I marry, what medical treatments I have, what medical treatments I refuse, why on earth can I not control the time and the manner of my dying? This is the 21st century. I have the right. What right have you doctors to stop me from exercising choice and control at the end of my life? And I don't have to be suffering. Interestingly, when the Lord Joffe proposed an assisted suicide bill several years ago, his bill said you had to have hopeless and unbearable suffering. Effectively, you had to have the same kind of thing that you have in Holland. Now, 2012, Faulkner comes out and says, we propose assisted dying bill, no mention of suffering. All you have to have is you have to have a consistent request to die, which is competent, and you have to have less than a year to live. And provided you have those things, no mention of suffering. You don't have to be suffering. It's all about your choice. It's all about autonomy. And so this, I think, is the much greater threat for us. Actually, it isn't about pain. It's about choice and control. And it's the fear of dependence. What modern people have, and this, again, is so wonderful and striking about the incarnation, that God makes himself a tiny, vulnerable, pathetic, dependent baby who can do nothing for himself. And yet, he is still the second person of the Trinity. His dignity and his status is in no way touched by his dependence. And at the end on the cross, as we said, he is again utterly and totally dependent, but his dependence doesn't change his dignity. And, you know, if God himself submits himself to be washed and fed and have his bottom wiped as a baby, then we too have to learn that if we come to a stage where we need to be washed and fed and to have our bottom wiped, our unique dignity, our status as a beloved princess or prince of the Most High, this is in no way touched by our dependence. But that is profoundly countercultural to modern people. They can't believe that. Dependence is undignified, dehumanizing, horrific. I was just struck by this. This was a cartoon in the equivalent of the BMJ. It's the journal of the Dutch Medical Association. So it's just coming from the Standard Doctors Association. And it shows this elderly person, an attired junior hospital doctor, and she's saying, would someone visit me for a last bit of comfort? And he says, I'll call him to come, madam. So what is the answer when someone is elderly and needs comfort? The answer is to call this one. That's what we do. That's what doctors do. So isn't that interesting, you know, symbolically? This wasn't done as this was just a sort of a cartoon en passant, just a bit of a laugh. But it sort of reflects something about the attitude of the medical profession. So from a Christian standpoint, intentional killing of an innocent human being is wrong. Why? Not primarily because of all the bad consequences in society. No, it's wrong because it contravenes something very deep. It's actually the moral order which is written in the universe. It lies behind the structure of the universe and which is written in our hearts. So one of the big differences in Christian understanding of ethics compared to many secular understanding of ethics is that in the secular understanding of ethics is basically something we invent. You know, as our clever apes developed on the African savannah, we had to come up with rules for living. And one of the rules we invented is that we don't kill one another. We invented it. It was a good idea. What Christian moral thinking says, we don't invent ethics. We discover it. It's actually already out there. We didn't come up with the idea that we shouldn't kill one another. No, this is actually something profound and deeply rooted in the structure of the universe. It's like a hidden grain. The moral order is like a hidden grain that's in the wood. Just as a wood has its own hidden grain. If you cut across the wood, what every carpenter discovers is that you have to go along the grain of the wood. Well, in the same way, the universe has a hidden grain. It has a hidden moral order. And if we live our lives along the grain of the moral order, our lives will flourish. But if we live our lives across the grain, then ultimately our lives will fail. And that's what the Bible calls the way of folly. So one of the interesting things, and you still see it in Holland, is that actually the doctors hate committing euthanasia. It's something they all loathe. It's something they try and resist. I heard one doctor saying, yes, I've done euthanasia a number of times. I always hate doing it. Whenever the patient start raises it, I say, not now, not now. We'll talk about it some other time. Eventually, it comes to the point where I can't resist it. I can't resist it. And then I always arrange it for a Friday afternoon. I go to the home. In fact, apparently one of the medical associations recommends that doctors don't drive themselves to the home when they're going to do euthanasia. You should have somebody to drive you because experience has shown that they often have accidents. He said, I always do it on a Friday afternoon. I do the act. I tidy up. I write out the forms. And then I go for long walks in the forest. I listen to a lot of Bach. And I try and prepare myself for Monday morning. Now, I found that actually quite reassuring. Because what it shows is that the moral order is still there. That this is actually not the way that we're called to treat other people. That the intentional killing is somehow still causes this deep sense that it's not right. So what has evolved is this idea that in palliative care, our aim is neither to accelerate the dying process, to try and bump off people as rapidly as possible, but nor is it to try and hold off death for as long as possible. What we do is we take the timing of death out of the equation and we concentrate on the other factors. And no doubt that's, Kathy's going to talk more about the practicalities of that. But I think that's quite a helpful way of thinking about it. We're neither trying to speed it up, but nor are we desperately trying to slow it down. But what we do have to make clear is that euthanasia is different. It's different from two things. It's different from withdrawing medical treatment, which is futile or burdensome, or where the patient is actively dying. This is an interesting, rather quaint phrase, but it's actually a very important thing. And in other words, part of our medical skill is to recognize the patient who is, quotes, actively dying, in the final stages of dying. And to be honest, this is something that the medical schools and our training programs don't teach us. And yet it's an incredibly important thing for every doctor, not just palliative care doctors. Every clinician needs to be able to recognize the patient who is actively dying. And it's a sort of physiological, you know, it is the spiral down of circulatory collapse, of gas exchange, of metabolic, you know, it's multiple mayhem, everything collapsing, the patient just dying in front of our eyes. When we see that, we recognize it, then it's meddlesome, it's wrong to try and oppose it. The patient is actively dying. But similarly, there are situations where if the treatment, this balancing of burdens and benefits, it's also very important. So if my treatment, whatever it is, intravenous antibiotics or mechanical ventilation or chemotherapy, whatever it is, if the burdens of treatment are much greater than the benefits of treatment, then it's abusive. We shouldn't be giving treatments which are burdensome relative to the benefits they give. That's wrong. That's immoral. And so stopping burdensome treatment is not euthanasia. It's good medical practice. And part of the fear that a lot of people have, the reason why they're in favor of euthanasia, is they don't trust us, the doctors. They don't trust us to say enough is enough. They don't trust us to stop the burdensome treatments. They think we're going to go on to the bitter end and they're going to end up in an ITU with tubes coming out of every orifice, and they don't trust us. And so we have work to do in regaining the trust of our patients, and that we do understand that enough is enough, and we are going to stop the treatment when it doesn't bring any good. And euthanasia is not the same as giving pain-killing treatment in order to benefit the patient, which may have the unintended side effect of shortening life. This is what philosophers call the principle of double effect, and it's recognizing that there is a moral difference between intention, intending to do something, and foreseeing the side effects of our actions. So intention is what we're aiming at. It's what we're seeking to achieve by our actions. Whereas foresight is the capacity we have as human beings to see risks and side effects of our actions, which may take place in the future, but which are not our aim. Now, this is often derided by our opponents as being some kind of strange, Jesuitical, Catholic, bizarre way of sort of calculating how many angels dance on the pins of the heads of pins and so on. But actually, it isn't that at all. It's a very fundamental moral principle which we all intuitively follow. We all know that medical treatments have recognized side effects. You can look in the BNF and there's a great long list of them. They're well known and recognized. But when you give a drug, your intention is not to have all those side effects. Your intention is the indication of what you're giving it. But you foresee that there might be bad side effects. That's different. So the most extreme example of this, I think, is where total body irradiation is used to destroy the bone marrow prior to bone marrow transplantation. Apparently, the doses of radiation used range from 10 to 12 grays. For comparison, the average lethal dose of radiation calculated from Hiroshima and other catastrophes is 4.5 grays. So they are giving twice the lethal dose of radiation. What kind of utter homicidal maniacs have we got in our bone marrow transplant departments? But of course, they're doing that with the intention to heal. You have to ablate the bone marrow and then you implant. Now that demonstrates, doesn't it, that there's a difference between intention and foresight. Now, of course, we recognize that you could have a homicidal maniac in the radiation department and it would be the sort of thing of a sort of shock horror medical novel, wouldn't it? You know, you could just think disaster. But we would recognize there's a difference. If somebody was using radiation to kill, they could be using exactly the same dose, but now the intention has changed. So the difference between intention and foresight is actually something we all deeply understand. It's part of the way we think. It isn't just some kind of strange moral Catholic idea. Now, often opiates are used as an example of double effect, that we give opiates, we know that they suppress respiration. Now, I understand, it'd be interesting with Kathy supports this, but I understand many palliative care doctors say, actually, in people who are dying, opiates often extend life rather than shorten life, because once that horrible pain and death feelings has gone, all of a sudden you say, what's for breakfast? You know, I feel a whole lot better now. So opiates don't necessarily, I think it's a bad example. We shouldn't be using opiates as an example of double effect, because it gives the idea that opiates are a really lethal, dangerous drug, which, used skillfully, they're not. But it's important to recognize that the drugs that are used by euthanasia doctors in the Netherlands and elsewhere are very different from the drugs of the palliative care doctors. Did you know that? Do you know what drugs they use in places like Dignitas? Or do they use opiates and benzodiazepines? Not they. They use barbiturates at about 50 times the normal therapeutic dose, grams of barbiturates. They use muscle relaxants, atricurium, and they use potassium chloride to stop the heart. In other words, the intention is revealed by the drugs you choose, isn't it? It's pretty clear what they're trying to do by that combination. The intention is to kill. Well, it's quite different from the drugs of the palliative care doctor, where the intention is to cure statement. So we need to understand there's a clear moral difference. That's not to say that it is possible for doctors intending to kill to cover their actions under the principle of double effect. It is. And therefore, it's standard practice for judges and juries to determine human intention by close analysis of their actions. And so I think one of the questions we need to ask ourselves is this one. what am I trying to achieve? What are my intentions? I think often as doctors, you know, we're pragmatists. We just sort of say, well, we'll do this treatment and we'll do that and we'll try something else and so on. We're not actually thinking, what are we trying to achieve? And I think when, particularly when in a sort of moral dilemma, this is the question to ask ourselves. What am I actually trying to achieve? What are my goals? What are my intentions? Because that often clarifies, in my experience, as we sit down and discuss, it often clarifies the discussion. What are we trying to achieve here? What are we? What's our goals? That's number one. Number two, how will I respond if the patient doesn't die? Because our critics often say, well, doctors are intending to kill, but they're just sort of covering their actions. Well, a useful test is to say, what would happen if, much to my surprise, when I give treatment X, the patient doesn't die as I anticipate, but actually starts getting better? This has happened to me on several occasions when I've withdrawn life support treatment in a neonate, and we've had this discussion with the parents, and I explain that the baby has got terrible brain damage and isn't breathing, and that when I remove the life support, that the baby will just gently slip away. And this was happening once, and the baby was in dad's arms, and the baby had just died and had gone white and limp and apneic. And I waited and I waited and I waited, and I said, I think she's just slipped away. And the baby goes, takes a huge gasp. And the doctor says, no, the dad says, oh, look, doctor, she's gone all pink. And I say, yes, she has, hasn't she? And basically that baby carried on breathing for 19 months, having just said she slipped away. And one of many great dog diagnostics actions of my clinical career. But what do I do then? Do I rush to the drug company cupboard and do the job properly, get out the potassium chloride? Well, if my intention was to kill, then yes, I would. That's what I would do. Or at least drug the baby up to the eyeballs with midazolam to try and stop the baby breathing. But no. Because my intention was not to kill, my intention was to remove treatment that was burdensome and futile, what we did is we put down a nasogastric tube, we gave the baby milk, we gave the baby TLC and nursing care, and looked after her, and she lived. So our intentions are revealed by what happens if it doesn't turn out as I expected. And then the third way that we can test ourselves is if there was an alternative treatment which controlled the symptoms just as well, but which didn't reuse respiration, would I use that instead? So just suppose the clever pharmacologists have come up with this new drug which is exactly as powerful as morphine or Diamorph in terms of symptom control and that nice euphoric feeling, but it has absolutely no respiratory depression. Would I use it instead of morphine? Now that's a test, isn't it? Because if my intention really is to stop the patient breathing, then I say, no, I'll stick with morphine. But if my intention is just to control symptoms, then I'd say, yes, I'd use the new drug. So we can, now in fact, sadly, that drug doesn't exist. But nonetheless, it's a sort of thought experiment, a way of testing our thinking in this play. So I think it's good to try and educate people about double effect and to encourage doctors to think about it, this fundamental difference between intention and foresight. I think it's good because it helps doctors to be more than just technicians. You know, so much of it, the emphasis in modern medical practice is just tell me the rules. I teach medical students ethics. And very often the answer is, don't bother me with all that moral stuff. Just tell me the rules. Tell me what I am allowed to do. Tell me what I'm not allowed to do. So that the whole of moral reflection turns into rule following. And I think we've got to resist that. No, we are moral agents. God has made us accountable for our actions, rational, responsible, moral beings. And therefore, we have to think about our actions and think about the actions of others. And I think this whole thing about the conscience, this is under great attack in our modern world. The secularists are specifically attacking the idea that doctors should have conscience. What is being said is if you have trained as a doctor at great expense by the state should be able to tell you what you do. And basically, every doctor should do what is legal. If the state has said it's legal for abortions, it's legal for whatever, and lo and behold, it's going to be legal for euthanasia, then why on earth should a few pesky religious people clog up the whole system? If you have a problem about this, you shouldn't have trained as a doctor. Go and find some other work. And that's what's being said, and we need to encourage ourselves, but also our colleagues, not all of whom believers, but who understand about the conscience, who understand that ultimately we are individual moral agents and we're accountable for our own actions. The final thing I just want to say, and this I'd be interested to discuss this later on, is I agree very much with what Peter has just said before, which is, unless there is the most astonishing change and spiritual renewal in our country, I'm afraid that some form of euthanasia is going to get legalized here in the UK and potentially within the next 5 years. And I think, of course, we hope and we pray and we work, and people like Peter campaign, that this doesn't happen, and quite right too. And the last thing we want to do is to stop doing any of this. But I am beginning to think that we should be starting, at least under quietly, to do this. In other words, just suppose we wake up in a few years' time and we turn on the Today program and it is announced, it is now legal. How are we going to respond? To me, the sad thing is that when you look in Holland and you look in Belgium and you look in Oregon, by and large, the Christian doctors have just laid down and been rolled over and have just accepted this as fait accompli. And some of them are persuaded this is probably for the best anyway. And I think, if one just did a thought experiment, what would happen if, and it's not just the Christian doctors, there's a majority of doctors in the UK who are opposed to euthanasia. What would happen if all those doctors came together and said, not on our watch, not in my practice, not in my ward, not in our trust, not in my hospital, and if the management wants us to do this, or if our practice managers wants to do this, then we're going to find ways of resistance. I think even if euthanasia was legalized, it could be an opportunity for actually to encourage people to start to think about some of these very profound things. I also think it's even possible to imagine that in sort of little shorthand, that you could end up with pro-life practices and pro-choice practices. You could end up with pro-life hospitals and pro-choice hospitals, and it would be interesting to know where most of the patients would want to go. I have a sneaking suspicion that an awful lot of patients would want to go to the pro-life doctors and the pro-life hospitals. And in particular, when their elderly mother, incontinent and demented, is being admitted, which hospital would you like to be admitted to? And I think there's an awful lot of people actually who would like the fact that they know that there's a doctor's who have taken particular stance and who says, we don't kill people here, this is not what we do. So I just want, but of course those kind of things, we don't want to wake up and discover it's happened and we're all totally on the back foot. I just wonder whether we should start to be thinking about how we might respond and what kind of resistance we might undertake if in fact, as I suspect may happen, unless God does an amazing miracle, may start to happen in our midst. I don't think we should despair. I think that actually there may be great opportunities as well as great dangers. Okay, thanks very much.